Hey, everybody. Welcome back and happy Skews Day to you. Today is June 29th, 2021. I'm Trey Crowder and that's Mark Agee. What's up, Mark?
What's up, Trey? Have you been on a plane yet since the COVID's winded down or whatever?
I've taken one flight, but it was months ago and it was kind of cool because it was a ghost town. Nobody was on it. I had a row all to myself, you know, so I didn't mind it. I imagine that's ending, though.
Yeah, airports are busy again and the airlines. So I flew a couple of times in the past month and my flights went pretty fine, except they got moved around a couple hours one way. But my mom's flight to come out to LA a couple weeks ago got moved a whole fucking day, right? It got moved up like 12 hours from mid Friday morning to mid Thursday evening. And apparently that shit's happening a lot and people are furious. Like airlines are grounding flights and they're blaming it on us. Apparently. So what they did is they took the bailout money and pocketed it and fulfilled the letter of the law by because the deal was you keep your employees employed and you get this bailout money, right? But they fired all their contractors. They only kept their salaried employees. Now they don't have enough contractors. And apparently you have to like have a bunch of like security clearances to work at the airport. Who knew? So they can't get people hired fast enough. And apparently we just have to eat shit because, yeah.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you, Mark. You have alarmed me very much with this because I'm not surprised by that, but that is upsetting because I was already going to take this opportunity to tell everyone that I'm going back on the road finally doing live comedy shows with senior Georgia correspondent Corey Ryan Forster and our buddy Drew Morgan on the Well Read Comedy Tour. You go to Well Read, that's Well R-E-D, wellreadcomedy.com, and check out our upcoming dates. Get your tickets. We sure would love to see you. But now I'm terrified because if I get a flight that's delayed by an entire day, that's a real problem. So I'm going to have to be flying in the whole days early and stuff. So, you know, I'm looking forward to that now. Thank you, Mark. But sincerely, thank you. That's good to know.
Yeah.
But it's also, that sucks.
Yeah. It's like how like NBA teams have to leave immediately after game and fly to the next town to be in a whole day early in case there are any travel problems. You got to do that. You got to leave town a day early, I guess, what you got to do.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it goes. Come see me out there. Hope to see y'all there. All right. So, with us as always, producer Matt doing his thing. This is Weekly Skews. Tonight is the night we learn to stop worrying and embrace the dumbassery. That's right. Every week it seems like we spend more and more time on the daily dumbass segment here at the Skews, such as the world we live in. And so tonight we're just embracing it. We've got some top shelf lunacy for you. We got everything from demonic pedophiles to 9/11 aliens and so much more. We also will discuss Toyota's big political gaffe. And then at the midway point, we'll be rescued from the depths of dumbassery by our guest this evening, Seattle capitalist and income inequality activist. Yeah, you heard that right. Nick Hanauer. Who will join us for a conversation on wage suppression and the reality of the uber wealthy in this country. And we're very much looking forward to it. Hope you are as well. All that and more on tonight's Skews, but we will begin with our first Daily Dumbass. Matt, graphic, please. Tonight's primary DD, publisher Simon & Schuster, for rejecting arguably the greatest title in the history of literature. If you don't know what I'm talking about, former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton put out a tell-all memoir entitled The Room Where It Happened. But it turns out that was not Bolton's preferred title for his book. No, Bolton wanted to call his memoir, quote, and I shit you not, a hard pounding. And Mark, it's apparently a Duke of Wellington quote that anyone could immediately recognize. And Mark, for some reason, the people at Simon & Schuster blanched at that suggestion. Do you think they made a mistake? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it was a mistake because that was actually Bolton's third choice. His first two were dicking down the Middle East and South America's hottest and wettest CIA coups. So,
no, he apparently got mad at them. Like when they rejected the title, A Hard Pounding, Bolton got mad and said that their heads were in the gutter, that no one would view it that way because it was a Duke of Wellington quote, which yeah. I believe I saw it earlier. I don't have it in front of me right now, but apparently the full Duke of Wellington quote was something like, it's a hard pounding, gents. We'll see in the end who pounds the hardest.
So, It's like, do you know how what kind of like up your ass Ivy League neocon you have to be to like, well, obviously when most people hear a hard pound, they think of the Duke of Wellington.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus Christ.
Now, I've said it before on the show, but like Donald Trump, obviously, I'm not a fan, but one of the funniest things I ever saw him do was when this book first came out, he went on this tirade on Twitter that seemed to be out of nowhere if you didn't know that the book was coming out about John Bolton. And it was just so that a sitting president was like, I'm paraphrasing, but he was like, of all the dumbass pieces of shit I ever encountered working in the White House, the dumbest, shittiest, quietest, loseriest one had to be John Bolton. He just went on a like midnight 15 tweet tirade about how much John Bolton fucking sucks. And, you know, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I detect no lies, man. The dude, when he's right, he's right, you know? I'm still amazed that he wasn't able to, like, trick Trump into a big war or two. That's, like, that's one in Trump's column.
Yeah, I agree with you. Everybody, I was worried that literally the whole world was going to explode once he got, you know, the codes and everything. And so far, that didn't happen. So, yeah, at least there's that. But speaking of Donald J. Trump, he is our first honorable mention for Daily Dumbass because he left the pedophile tunnels under the White House. That's an odd choice. You'd think he'd want to close those up, being the Kraken and all, or however all that shit works. But no, he just left them there. What am I talking about? Well, we'll let fellow Tennessean and longtime nemesis of mine. That's not true. He's just been around as long as I've been around. Pastor Greg Locke explain that and so many other things in a brief 90 seconds. He brings the heat right here. Matt, play the clip.
I don't know why pastors don't talk about this stuff. Well, I do. They don't want to seem crazy. I'm already crazy. People like, do you really think it's that much of an epidemic? Do you honestly believe, how am I going to get somewhere crazy? Do you honestly believe, Pastor Locke, that the military uncovered tunnels beneath the Capitol building and beneath the White House and in the Five-Fingered Lakes? Do you really believe that they found kids? Yeah, both live ones and dead ones. And if you disagree with that, and if you try to discount that, and if you try to cover that, and if you try to keep that on the DL, you're just as complicit as Hunter Biden and the rest of them bunch of crack-smoking perverts.
Oh, man. I mean, dude, bringing it. Great energy. Great stage presence, you know. Like,
he's killing it. Yeah, he's killing it.
Dude, they love it.
I can't he'd be like, I don't know if he believes what he's saying, but like, I think the person that'd be maddest about, like, are the people who think that's true, that there are a bunch of dead kids under the Capitol and under the White House, and all they're doing is posting on Facebook about it.
Right.
That's the most insane thing to me. It's like, I don't know what I'd do if it was true and I believed it, but it seems kind of futile to just be like, that's the worst thing in the world happening. I guess I got to go to work and then Facebook, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, that is weird now that you mention it. Cause like Louis C.K. had that bit about like people bombing abortion clinics and stuff. He's like, look, they believe that babies are being murdered. I don't agree with that. But if you believe babies are being murdered, you're going to do some pretty wild shit. And that's sort of where we're at right now. Although, I mean, I guess, you know, the wild shit they did was storming the Capitol building or whatever. But now that that's already happened, you know, what are they doing now, Mark? What's next?
Shit. You go to church and call yourself crazy about it. I don't know. It's first of all, I wish I had his charisma. You know where we could be if I had his charisma, Trey?
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's a long history of comedians sort of drawing from the stage presence and the methods of preachers, you know, Sam Kinison and also Chris Rock and a lot of comics. There's like a lot of overlap between like how you go about it, you know, and like we were saying, this dude, for what he's doing, murdering. Mm-hmm. They love it. He's up there bringing the noise. Yeah, but obviously full bore lunatic who's been at this for a while now and shows no signs of stopping. So
See, where I'm from, my preacher nemesis was Jerry Falwell and then Jerry Falwell Jr., but I'm glad to know you have your own televangelist nemesis.
Well, actually, so what had happened was, Mark, and I've told the story a million times, but that liberal redneck video I did about the transgender bathroom laws in North Carolina, the first one that went crazy viral or whatever, the direct inspiration for that was I saw this very Greg Locke type of pastor in the state of North Carolina who posted a rant online standing in the woods by his truck about the evils of transgender people in the bathrooms and our baby girls and all this type of stuff, but like not a dick joke in sight, wasn't even trying to be funny, just pure fire and brimstone. And it had like 15 million views, and that literally was the moment that I was like, oh, there's maybe something here. You know, like if I make fun of this dude, then maybe there's something to that. So like I have always thanked that guy and also his Lord for, you know, getting me to this point. Like it's his fault and or the Lord's fault. But right after that, Greg Locke, who's the Tennessee guy, he was in on the transgender thing too, all at the same time. So I was shitting on him at the time, and yada yada, or whatever. But it was actually this other dude who started it all. But yeah, Greg Locke's been on the radar for a while.
Did I ever tell you about the time Jerry Falwell Jr. called me a liar?
No, but please do.
All right, so when Jerry Jr. got let go from his job at Liberty a couple of months ago, and it was like, oh, they're letting go because he's an alcohol problem. Like, who knew he had a drinking problem? I did, because one time I posted a story about Jerry Jr., like about how everybody hates the Falwells. A lot of people hate Falwells around South Virginia because they do stuff like they kept Hooters out of Lynchburg. And they remember that NC-17 movie where Elizabeth Banks was a stripper? Do you know what I'm talking about? I can't think of the name of it right now. But anyway, that movie came out. And if you want to see it, you drive all the way to Richmond to see it because they kept that out of Lynchburg. And he just responded to me, called me a liar. And he responded at like 1 a.m. East Coast time where he was name searching himself on Twitter. And I was I was like, that dude has a drinking problem. That was like 2015. So.
Yeah. No, it's good. You know, good to have enemies like that, in my opinion. Yeah. Next up on our list, talking about dumbasses, there was a Trump rally this weekend in Ohio, and he invoked the name of one of Ohio's greatest heroes. Who exactly? Well, it's kind of hard to say based on how he framed it. Matt, if you want to play this clip, pretty funny.
And that sent a brave young man from Ohio to a plant. Think of it. Sent, you know who the man I'm talking about is? Who am I talking about? Do you know who it is? The stars and stripes on the face of the moon. Do you know who the man is, right? Do you know? Huh? Do you know?
To a plant. A brave young man from Ohio to a plant. The funniest, like, longest running joke about the fact that Ohio has more astronauts than anyone else is that, like, that's how desperate people are to get as far away from Ohio as possible, is that they all go to the fucking moon because nowhere is far enough away. Hey, I love Ohio. I'm just repeating what I've heard. But, yes.
Yeah. That's obviously a joke someone from Michigan came up with, so I dig it.
For sure.
Matt, what says
he moved to Matt, producer Matt, is from Ohio, and he says, I just moved to Seattle. So, yeah, there you go.
I don't have any problem with it. But I do want to say, like, I'm trying to guess what happened there. I'm guessing his teleprompter said something about another planet, and he misread it.
Still
but also
isn't.
Yeah. Right. So, but anyway, then he also forgot the name Neil Armstrong or couldn't read his teleprompter. And yeah, then,
someone please tell me who this is.
It turns into a pop.
About. Guy went to a plant or whatever.
Yeah.
Send somebody to Chernobyl, or does he mean like a famous tree climber? What's he mean? A plant?
Have you noticed that people, even sitting behind him, they always put the most loyal supporters behind him. Even people, they were starting to trickle out and leave. You see any footage from there, like a bunch, he spoke for like 90 minutes. A bunch of people left like 30 minutes in. The people were just like filtering out. Like it was like, like you went to a Jimmy Buffett concert and you already played Cheeseburger, so you just like start bailing, right?
Yeah,
just totally wild. He's lost it. He's lost it. He's gonna have the magic anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. They're still pretty fired up, as our next entry will prove. Our next honorable mention for Daily Dumbass. Anybody who's upset at the fact that boys will be boys. Okay, that's what happened on January 6th. If you don't believe me, hear it from this attendee of Trump's aforementioned rally in Ohio this weekend on this interview with CNN.
Do you think your guys who went inside shouldn't have gone inside or what?
Yeah, I don't think anybody should have went inside. But, you know, when you're worked up in that moment and, you know, the adrenaline's pumping, I mean, it just happens.
Are you worried that we could see more violence?
Yeah. I honestly believe it's coming.
So I don't know if you noticed, Trey, but so that clip, that guy was basically confessing to being there on January 6th and to being the three percenters, even though he denies going in the building. But the song playing in the background during the whole interview is My Own Worst Enemy by Lit, which I just
the more this shit goes on and the more we cover it, the more it's like in my head, I'm like, I don't know, maybe I should believe in some type of God, or this is a simulation or something. It's just like, there's so many things that are too perfect about that. Like, it's always the most on the nose shit, the details of this. Cause like you said, you got to strain to hear it, but in the background is the song My Own Worst Enemy by Lit playing while this guy explains the rationale for them rushing the Capitol and how it really wasn't that big of a deal. It's unreal. What?
Why the power pop punk band from 2004? Why is it 98? When was that? I don't know. But it's like, why? Like, how is that the demo for a bunch of boomers?
Well, dude, I mean, it gets so much more egregious than that. There was that famous viral clip of those people at a Trump rally or wherever that was, or maybe it was on January 6th. Those people rocking out to "Killing in the Name of" by Rage Against the Machine. Like, they just. They have no self awareness where that's concerned at all.
That was in Philadelphia during the election count, but they're trying to stop the vote, but the stop the steal or whatever. But yeah, the woman was draped in a Blue Lives Matter flag, singing about those who work forces are the same who burn crosses. It's like, you know what you're talking about.
It's so weird how they can, like, clearly they know the lyrics because they can parrot them. Mm-hmm. But somehow don't in any way interpret them, because like lyrics like that, some of those who work forces are the same who burn crosses. I don't know how you misinterpret that and turn it into a Blue Lives Matter anthem. Like, if you told me it's like, oh, they just like the sound of the song because it's hard and gets you fucking fired up or whatever, that's one thing. But if they illustrate that they do know what the lyrics are, how the hell do you explain that level of cognitive dissonance, mental gymnastics?
Well, I think the lyric they like from that song is "fuck you, I won't do what you tell me," which is their whole ethos, but not like the song is like workers telling it to bosses and poor people telling it to cops. To MAGA people, they're like yelling at like prescription bottles, and like the weather report, and like, I don't know, wearing shoes in stores and shit. It's like, Jesus Christ, that's what they think freedom is.
I've also seen these people who obviously follow Tom Morello, the guitarist, on Twitter, whatever. He's a super liberal, always has been. Obviously. And he'll tweet something and people will be in his replies, be like, hey, you know what? Why don't you just stick to playing the guitar? You know, the sort of like the shut up and dribble type of thing, which is so funny when it's Tom Morello, because it's like, hey, you know, why don't you just go back to Raging Against the Machine, okay? Like, keep your politics out of it, and you just stick to Raging Against the Machine. That's what we would prefer.
Yeah. Oh,
these people.
I do want to step in for Tom here. I think he'd be offended you called him a liberal. I think he'd say he's a socialist or a hardcore leftist, but yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Next up on the Daily Dumbass Rundown, 90s comics who failed to realize that women not only be shopping, they also be driving. That's right. Women be driving. And so because of that, infrastructure is really a woman's problem. This is all coming from Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who said, well, pretty much what I just told you. He said that roads and bridges are a woman's problem. Because oftentimes it is the woman, aside from commuting to work, they don't do that, clearly. Aside from the whole work thing, it's the woman who's out driving around, taking children to schools, doing the shopping. More time she spends on that road, the less time she spends doing things of higher value.
The subtext of this was fantastic, because like there was a Meet the Press, and Chuck Todd was asking him, like, how are you going to explain your bipartisan vote for the infrastructure bill to the hardcore partisans, right, who think you shouldn't make any deal with Biden? And he was basically trying to reframe the infrastructure bill as pro-family values, saying, like, if you make better roads for the broads, they'll be home to cook you dinner. Right. I mean,
Yeah, they won't be stuck out at the stores spending all your money shopping all goddamn day. They'll be able to make it home and make you a casserole and prepare your recliner and make your Manhattan and give it to you as you walk in the door and rub your feet and all that good stuff. If they didn't have to spend so much time out on these goddamn sorry ass roads. This is one of those things where it's like, dude, we need better roads. You know what I mean? Like spending money on infrastructure, I'm all for it. And it's just the way they comp it. So it's like, the ends justifying the means or whatever. Like if he's going to vote for infrastructure bills, fucking that's great. But it's just hilarious the road they take to get to a, you know, common sense landing point.
It is like you can't just do good public policy. It all has to be filtered through the Bible. You can't, like, we just had a bridge collapse, a couple of days ago, last week, and hurt a few people. Thank God, nobody was hurt, like the real bad building collapse in Florida. Right. But, like, you can't just be like, it's bad to get crushed by bridges. It's got to be like, if your wife gets crushed by a bridge, she won't be able to birth you any more offspring, like God wants.
Yeah. Ah, man. I don't know. There's something else. All right. Next up, we got an update on that crazy ass Arizona recount that we talked about a couple times here on the show. Mark, QAnon, that's the subject at hand. So why don't you take us through some of this? It is hilarious.
All right. So the guy we talked about before, the guy from Cyber Ninja Security, who's running he's basically does computer software security, and he's not very good at it. He runs a shitty little company that's never done anything before. But he got hired to run the Arizona recount, and he does nothing about elections. And so he's been presenting himself as this is a nonpartisan effort to uncover whether there was any vote fraud to restore faith in the election process, right? That's his pitch for it. But he also, it turns out, he's the star of this documentary that just came out called The Deep Rig, where his face is blurred out through the whole thing, but his voice was not disguised. So everyone who saw the trailer automatically knew it was him, even though they make a big point in the documentary. And at the end, the big climax of the movie is they unpixelate his face and show you that he's the guy who actually knows about all the fraud. He's a source for all this. But the documentary also calls him an Anon, which, of course, is QAnon lingo for one of the people who, like, deciphers Q posts. But even the better part about this is the guy that directed this documentary. His name is Roger R. Richards, so let's call him Triple R. He's had another documentary he made 3 years ago. And let's just start by showing you the trailer for it because it is something else.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
The Germans had a settlement on the moon, they had a settlement on Mars, and they were doing this as early as 1939.
Between the age of 16 and 17 years old, I was transported to the moon, and after 20 years, I was age regressed back in time and then returned to civilian life.
Extraterrestrial spacecraft have appeared over nuclear missile installations and have completely powered them down.
All right. So, you get it. 9/11 aliens.
In the trailer, it also says that the Nazis had a moon base and a colony on Mars in 1939. And the best, that's probably the best part, but the thing that's even crazier probably, let's say it's crazier, who cares? It's not in the trailers. Apparently, the documentary argues that aliens were behind 9/11, right? What the government is hiding from us is we are in a hot shooting war with aliens, and we are apparently holding our own. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, Mark, you know me. I'm into the alien stuff. I think they're here. But come on. The idea that they were behind 9/11, abject lunacy. Anyone could tell. But now, this new documentary starring the man who's in charge of the Arizona recount, that it was brought to you by the man who made the Alien 9/11 documentary. Again, it's like I was saying earlier, every single thing related to these people that comes out, like every little detail, is just more absurdly ludicrous than the one before it. It's wild.
Can I ask you, like, when you're triaging your priorities in life, all right, you're a person who believes, again, that we are facing imminent alien invasion, and you're worried about vote machines – in an Arizona suburb.
Right.
What? Why are you wasting your time on that, man? You need to be fucking building the laser gun or some shit. I don't know.
Wow. You'd be like practicing. A very good point. All right. So listen, before we get Nick out here in a few minutes, Mark, let's talk a little bit about tax stuff, rich people stuff. The latest ProPublica tax expose, Mark, which said what?
So, so we've talked a little bit about, since the theme tonight is class war a little bit, there was a ProPublica that we talked a couple weeks ago about their expose of like breaking down some tax filings they got a hold of from America's ultra wealthy. And the latest one is about how Peter Thiel, who was on the board of Facebook and founded the surveillance company Palantir, I can't think of the name of it right now. But he took a $2,000 Roth IRA, which he shouldn't have been eligible for, but he rigged his finances to look like a middle-class person. And he turned that $2,000 Roth IRA into $5 billion in untaxable investment income. And it's perfectly legal. What he did is perfectly fine. It goes against the spirit of the law, and he may be engaged in a little light fraud too. What he did was once PayPal, which is a company he founded, went public, he had an analyst price PayPal shares at 0.001 cents a share, so you could buy that many shares with $2,000, which is how he turned it into $5 billion. But I don't know what to say about this stuff anymore. It's fucking nuts. And if you don't know anything about Thiel, he's quite an interesting character. He's a libertarian who thinks women shouldn't be allowed to vote. And he also finances a bunch of lunatic right wing. He's also bankrolling J.D. Vance's Senate campaign. So that's a little bit of a connection to our world.
It seems like they both play by different rules than the rest of us, but also that's not enough. They exploit the rules that do apply to everyone else. Do you know what I mean? And so with that said, let's bring our guest out here. Our guest this evening is Seattle-based capitalist and activist who in 2015 founded Civic Ventures and Civic Action, a group of political troublemakers devoted to ideas, policies, and actions that catalyze significant social change. By thinking, writing, and acting outside the realm of conventional political discourse, Civic Ventures drives the economic conversation and fundamentally alters the status quo in Seattle, Washington State, and the U.S. at large. He's also my good buddy from way back. That's right. It's Mr. Nick Hanauer. Nick, are you there? There he is.
I think I'm here.
Hey, you're here. Okay. Good to see you, man. Good to see you. It's been a while. I'm doing good. That's Mark Agee there, my venerable co-host, and we're thrilled to have you with us.
Good to see you.
So, Nick, the first thing I ever found out about you, so people don't know what the hell I'm talking about. You and I have done some things in the past, made some videos together, things like that. And but the first thing I ever found out about you was this this article you wrote in 2014. It was said the pitchforks are coming, where you were essentially trying to warn other uber wealthy Americans that, listen, guys, income inequality is getting worse and worse, and eventually they might kill us if we don't back off on this. There's a breaking point to all of this, and we probably should be more worried about it. Well, Nick, that's 7 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering where you're at on all that at this point in time, what kind of progress you've made or how you feel about that whole dynamic in 2021.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel largely vindicated. I believe the words we used in that piece were a police state or an uprising or both. And I don't think that there's a better way to think about the Trump years other than as effectively a populist uprising.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that 4 years represented, the shit show that, represents that kind of anger, right? The only thing that recommended Donald Trump to his minions was the fact that he was angry and wanted to burn everything down, and so did they, and that's what elected him. And, I think that what he did and the continuing assault on the democracy is all the evidence that you need that most people but certainly a huge proportion of Americans feel like the country doesn't represent their interests, isn't worth saving, and or certainly the institutions aren't worth saving, and are effectively ready to burn the whole thing down. And for sure, if he had been reelected or if he had been able to.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Claim reelection, I think things would have gotten really hairy.
Yeah.
Terrible. And so, I think that we're still on the bleeding edge of that kind of civil breakdown. And, I think it's, if you're not worried, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
It's sort of like one thing that's interesting to me about that the sort of ideas is like when the people have a certain assumptions about how America works, right? It's democracy and it's free and American dream is like right there for me to have. And when it doesn't work that way, people start assuming that there must be some unseen force screwing them, right? Instead of the seen forces. So like it feels like to me conspiracy theories and disinformation are like what's filling that space. And that's sort of like bigger picture what's happening right now, that like our institutions are being torn apart because they're not functioning the way they're supposed to. So people assume they must be under the control of some like unseen force, like a pedophile cabal or what have you,
Okay. But to be fair, those institutions for the last 45 years have been controlled by an unseen force, which was the neoliberal economic world order. And I think that, which is basically a set of ideas and policies embraced by both Republicans and Democrats, that enriched the few and savaged the many. And I think for the purposes of this conversation, I think it's really important to root it in just some numbers and facts. So the median full-time worker in America today earns about $50,000 a year. If they had been held harmless by the last 45 years of neoliberal economic policy, instead of earning $50,000 a year, they'd earn between $90,000 and $100,000 a year. And that gap between $50,000 and $100,000 really explains a huge proportion of the social maladies that we face today. So you just have to think about what the country would be like if the typical person made $100,000 and not $50,000. Among other things, there would be no government debt because everybody would have paid a lot more taxes. but certainly the kind of pain and anger and difficulty that most citizens face today would be much less. And so, that objective reality, right, the facts of the matter are that for most people, they saw their lives get shittier and harder, while a few of us, lived beyond the dreams of avarice, right? And, oh, shit, sorry.
You good?
Live, it happens.
That's my alarm to make sure that I don't miss. that gap, it has effectively shredded the reciprocity norms that make social cohesion and democracy possible. And so a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues think that you can fix this with politics, like better political leaders and better narratives and stuff like that. And I just don't agree. I think that the only thing that fixes this is economics, is actually materially changing the lives of the majority of citizens. Because if people feel like they're getting a fair shake, if they feel like their kids have a chance, if they feel like they can retire in security and dignity, well, then the institutions are worth saving. But if they're not, fuck it, right? Like,
right.
You can understand the logic.
For sure. Well, there's recently there's been this whole narrative about people aren't coming back to work at fast food restaurants and things like that. And of course, like conservatives have had this narrative of, well, they've gotten, why would they? they're getting this unemployment, they're getting these like COVID benefits, and it's made them lazy and people don't want to work anymore, right? And they call it a labor shortage. But economically speaking, a genuine labor shortage is addressed by raising wages, right?
Correct.
Because that's how that works.
Exactly, yeah.
And
yeah,
they won't do that and still continue to push this false narrative. And it seems pretty simple, but they're just, that's how stuck in their ways they are when it comes to not paying people anymore, right?
That's right. You have to remember, I mean, all of this is bullshit. So first, if you examine the rate at which folks are able to hire people in the states where they've cut off these UI benefits versus the states that still have them, you will find that the rates at which people can hire people are the same, right? Which leads you to believe that whether people are getting UI or not doesn't seem to have any effect on businesses' capacity to hire. It turns out that anybody who's ever hired a bunch of people knows that it takes months and months to sort through candidates to find folks to hire. And you know, that downturn scared the crap out of most business people, and most people shrank their operations, and now they have to gear up, and it's hard and it takes time. That being said, I do think that the pandemic forced a lot of people to reexamine their lives and ask a bunch of, I think, important, smart questions about what they want to do with the rest of them. And it may be very true that a lot of people who had really terrible, shitty jobs before may be pursuing other paths. But, you know, the Republican answer that the way to manage a society is with fear sort of privation, that if we just make people poor enough, they'll do whatever we want. Because if they don't come to work for us, they'll starve to death. Like, I don't think that's a great way to govern.
No. Right. Well, it's also this idea of like, you know, if you work hard, you will succeed in this country. And it's like these people are working their asses off,
right,
and can't pay their rent, don't have health insurance, and
that's
whatever,
right,
all that. And so they reach the conclusion of, well, fuck all that. You know,
yeah,
like,
right.
What is the point of doing that if that isn't how it actually works?
That's right.
And so you had a recent article in The Hill talking about wage suppression,
correct,
keeping the wages down. You've been advocating for a higher minimum wage for years now.
Yeah.
Do you think that this whole recent dynamic with people having trouble hiring and this whole conversation surrounding it will make any kind of difference in that regard? Where do you think we're going in terms of wage suppression and the minimum wage?
Well, I think that, you know, the article that I co-authored was with the main author, a guy named Larry Michel, is one of the country's leading labor economists, who did an analysis of why wages didn't keep up. And the conventional view, like the story that most Americans have been told and that they bought over the last 30, 40 years, is these inexorable, you know, unchangeable forces in economics, like automation and globalization and stuff like that, that kept people's wages down. And this turns out to be a complete lie, that basically people's wages stopped growing because of a set of very deliberate things a bunch of very powerful people did in the service, theoretically, of growth to actually suppress wages, right? Like, so if the minimum wage had tracked productivity gains, today it'd be about $22 an hour. And obviously a bunch of people worked super hard to make sure that did not happen, right? Let me remind you that if you work if you're a tipped worker, the national minimum wage is $2.13,
yep,
plus tips, which is suspiciously close to slavery. I mean, at what point, $2.13 is almost zero, right? Like,
right,
it's kind of crazy. And you know, that piece of work was important because it showed people that this didn't happen to us. We did it to ourselves effectively. And that's the bad news. The good news, of course, is you can undo it. You can enact a new set of policies that can substantially increase wages for folks, and we should. And the gap between what folks in the bottom nut are making and what they should make is about $2.5 trillion per year. which is the amount of money you could transfer before you felt like you had gone too far. And the $15 minimum wage, just for argument's sake, is in the range of about $450 billion if you implemented it nationally of that $2.5 trillion. So even if you did that, you've only taken a teeny bite out of the real problem.
I was going to say, like, in your Hill article, you point out that the 43% gap between productivity and median compensation, right? And you also started pushing for a $15 minimum wage, I think, in 2013, which, of course, inflation would make that $17, $18, $19 by now, right, or whatever. So, like, correct, that's all that, even that fight for 15 is like a good example of the productivity gap because it's already old, right?
No, that's right. Yeah. We started the first time we talked about a $15 minimum wage was in the fall of 2012.
Wow.
And you know, and we're nowhere near implementing that nationally, obviously, although we've made a huge amount of progress and probably moved $150, $200 billion a year in the states where we have enacted it. But there is so far to go to get the typical working person whole again. And, you know, that's, again, that's the bad news. The good news is that, you know, these are not revolutionary steps. This is the frustrating part, is like, we could very easily fix most of these problems. And would rich people like me make a little bit less? Yeah, we'd make a little bit less, but we don't have to tear the whole country down to get everything back on track. If rich people paid a little bit more in tax and big corporations were required to pay people enough to get by without food stamps, and we did three or four other things, you know, you get to $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion pretty quickly. I mean, we do have to unscrew our healthcare system, which is basically the world's largest price fixing scheme. And that will take a lot of work because there's a lot of embedded interest in keeping things just the same. But I do think that, you know, if we grind away, and certainly, I mean, I will tell you, nobody has been more surprised than me about how damn good the Biden administration has been thus far. Joe and his team have really done an outstanding job of driving the right narrative and being bold and aggressive. And so I do think that there's some hope here.
Well, what about, you said, you know, rich people like me, you said, and again, you're, that article we were talking about, like, listen, the pitchforks are going to come for us. Like, has there been any shift in attitude at all in either direction amongst that cohort, amongst your peers, you know, where all this is concerned?
I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, like, when I started talking about inequality in 2008, 9, 10, people like in my peer group, people got defensive and angry. Like, if you even brought it up, people would, first of all, nobody would even agree that there was inequality. And if there was, it's not my fault and blah, 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 blah. And today you really have to scrape the bottom of the conservative barrel to get people to be just like, no, it's not a problem. Fuck the poor. Right. Like, you know, like, my wife and I are, members of a very hoity-toity group called the Giving Pledge, which is this group of jillionaires who pledge to give away at least half their wealth during their time. And it includes, I don't know, like, some double-digit percentage of the richest people in the world. It was founded by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and so on and so forth. And, you know, in the years that we have been part of that, I have watched a transition from people being like, what, inequality, to like people really like talking about it a lot and feeling like we have to do stuff about it. Now, of course, the devil's in the details. I mean, and in the law, it's not in the details, it's in the laws, right? That you have to pass laws. Nothing will change because rich people feel bad, right? That is not good enough. The world does not operate on the kindness of strangers.
It's that whole big government thing, you know, that they argue against, but you have to, you know, like the EPA, where the environment is concerned, like, they're not going to do that stuff themselves. They're just not, like, you have to force them to do it.
You have to regulate
these people. You have to force them to pay it. And that kind of opens up the question of these, you know, loopholes that we were talking about earlier, you know, that ProPublica article about Peter Thiel and the Roth IRA.
Saw that.
So, like,
what a douchebag.
Right, for sure. So, God, absolutely. Yeah. On, like, what do people, regular people, like Mark and I and our listeners and most of us, like, not truly grasp about the reality of the uber wealthy in this country where all that is concerned, you know, how all that really works.
And you wonder why people are pissed off.
Right.
It's like, you know, I can't pay my rent and this guy is using a Roth IRA to salt away whatever it is, $5 billion. Or
yeah.
What a douche. You know, here's the thing is that it's just a truism of human behavior that, given any system, there will be people who try to game it.
Right.
Right. And the reason that standards are so important is that if you don't hold folks to a high standard, the terrible people like Peter Thiel drag down everybody else, right? Like honestly are lots of people who run big companies who would love to pay people 15 or 20 bucks an hour, but if their direct competitors are only paying them $7, you're existentially threatened if you do the right thing. And that's why it's not really fair to look at a big company and say, well, how come you don't pay 20 bucks an hour? You should do it. It's the right thing. You know, like, you know, people who run companies do have a responsibility to, you know, like make sure that they continue to be able to operate. And that's why standards, you know, both in wages and all these other things are so damn important. So that effectively protects the good people doing the right thing from the bad people doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, like, I don't know, but I don't think very many of my friends are salting away billions in Roth IRAs. My financial advisors have never come to me with that scheme. just like, you know, like you gotta muck around with the worst of the worst to end up there.
But I really, really want it.
Yeah, there are always people like that, right? Like there will never not be people like that, and you just have to stay after them and shame them and ideally put them in jail.
The one interesting thing to me about your various projects, from the TED Talks to the Pitchfork op-ed, is like your audience is felt as other wealthy people, right? Which is like there's an implicit argument in that like basically you're saying you guys we've captured control of these institutions and the government, and you're basically a hostage negotiation. Well, please release some of the government so they can govern again and we can get things back on track. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, so the yes and no. So, mm-hmm. I think it's really important to underscore for folks how deeply these terrible economic ideas got into the heads of even good people. And you know, like if you know, Shakespeare said, first kill all the lawyers, and he was right about everything except the lawyers. It was the economy, right? Like, yeah. Because look, when I started on this path, even left-wing Democratic senators believed, like absolutely believed, like in gravity, that if you raise wages, it killed jobs because the economy was, they learned in college that the economy was this Pareto optimal equilibrium system where if one thing went up, another thing went down. And so good people on our side enacted policies that harmed most people and made a few people rich, all the while absolutely believing that it was good for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that set of ideas we call neoclassical economics, and the weaponized kind of public version of that we call neoliberalism, which includes things like raising wages kills jobs and tax cuts for the rich create growth and regulation is bad for productivity and growth and people are paid what they're worth and on and on and on. Just a bunch of ideas which are internally consistent and supported by traditional economic thinking, but are just not true. And so some of what went wrong was from nefarious bad people, but some of it was just good people trying to do the right thing and fucking up. And that gives me hope, because if you kill neoliberal economic ideas and neoclassical economics And we are doing a good job of that right now. Like we have these people on the run, and get people to recognize that, you know, raising wages doesn't kill jobs. In fact, it creates jobs, because when workers have more money, they buy more stuff and people hire people, right? If you can begin to crack this open, you create a green field for better policy and you can get a lot of great stuff done. And for every one of me, there's 9,999 of other people, right? Like, we do live in a democracy. And if you can get people to like begin to see these facts, whether they are Republican or Democrat, you can begin to drive policy in the right direction, right? There's, I mean, you know, not all Republicans are brain damaged racists, right? Yeah. Like, some of them just want to live decent middle class lives, and you can teach those people that those are lies too. And you can create a super majority of people who actually prefer economic policies that benefit the middle class and lead to actual economic growth, rather than a few people basically stealing shit like what's going on Wall Street today.
So okay, kind of on that note, first of all, Dick, thank you for joining us. It's been great, as I knew it would be, but you kind of touched on there, like this mission you have, right? Like, what do you got going on right now? How can people check it out, support it? What do you want people to know? That type of thing, you know, just sure you plug what you need to plug. Yeah, man, fight the good fight.
I'd love for folks to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Nick Hanauer. And you know, my mission, our mission, and you know, we collaborate with a bunch of people, is to tear down neoliberalism and replace it with a new set of economic ideas. So the next set of economic policymakers and political leaders enact policies that benefit the whole country and normal people rather than just people like me. And, you know, I don't do that because I love to pay more tax or because I'm just such a, you know, moral dude. I just want to live in a country where I can drive down the street and not feel like I'm going to get carjacked because people are so poor or pissed off.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, all of our work at Civic Ventures supports that. And you know, sadly, you know, I don't need anybody's money. I don't know what to say. You know, like, I groove on the support, but there's not a lot that people can do to help directly. So
yeah, just anyway. Follow and care and be down with the cause, yeah, you know,
right.
But no, Nick, you know, wish we had at least 1,000 more like you, brother. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And more like you too, Trey.
My man. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Let's do it again.
I can't wait. See you later.
All right, bud.
All right. Take care. Nick Hanauer, everybody. Yeah, you know, I appreciate his optimism, you know, towards the end there. Like, we can do this. I hope he's right. It seems like it's a manageable thing, making people realize that they're being fucked over, whatever side they sit on. So, you know, we will see. All right. So we can get into the questions and comments. Let's at least mention Toyota's bullshit. So as y'all are sending us the Q's and C's there, Toyota, it was determined, donated more than anyone else to the group of senators, the group of Congress people who voted. Ah, shit. What was it? Yeah. Stolen election conspiracy loans in Congress. All the people who said the election was stolen. It turns out Toyota was the highest supporter of those people, generally
speaking. By a mile.
On average, $55,000, like, across the 30-some-odd Congress people.
No. So, 50,000. Here's the funny thing about this. I think it was $55,000 total they donated.
Oh, what? Really?
Yes. Yes.
Wait, so, hold on. What?
Yes.
This entire number we're talking about is 55. I literally just assumed it was like on. Okay.
Yeah. So divide 55 by 37, and that's how much Toyota.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Hold on. I'm sorry. I wasn't fixing to boycott Toyota either way, but what is this? What am I missing? Why are we even talking about this if that's literally the amount of money we're talking about?
Well, the thing that's funny to me is that Toyota dug in and they put out a statement, which is one of the most tone deaf things I've ever seen. It's like, we don't think it's fair to judge a politician based solely on their vote to not certify the 2020 election, which is like the most important thing they do probably as a continuation of democracy. That was really funny. But two, the fact they're digging in instead of retracting $55,000 in donations spread out over 37 people is they are pretty confident they have purchased 37 congresspeople for about $1,200 each. which is extremely funny to me.
You know, they're going to have, like, there's going to be a lot of fucking insurrection-y type fucking old boys looking to buy a Toyota now. You know what I mean? Which is ironic because for years, at first, it was like amongst the more redneckier, more stereotypically redneckier of our populace, it was like, can't buy those goddamn Japanese cars, buy American. And then they were the Prius people. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Toyota's been persona non grata amongst that cohort for a long time. So it's funny that now, because of this, which I'm just finding out is like, based on not really that much money in the grand scheme of things, you're going to have old boys lining up to buy Tundras and shit. Man, what a ridiculous time we live in.
Well,
I thought it was 55,000 on average per whatever.
No.
Wow. That's
So with that, that's what makes it also so much funnier to me. But like the other end of it, like, first of all, I think rednecks should have loved Toyotas the whole time, because if you see any pictures in the Middle East, you know, they're great for mounting a gun to bed of. So that's,
One thing. Yeah. I had a joke in my act about that forever, about fucking the overlap between rednecks and those motherfuckers. If I can ride around shooting guns in the air in the back of a pickup truck, hits for them.
Hell yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Those are called technicals, by the way. I'm not sure what it's named for, but a gun mounted in the back of a Toyota is called a technical. But also like the lib flip out of Toyota is really funny, because it's like, why did you think Toyota was a good company? Just because they made Prius? Everybody here drives a Prius. Like, you thought that like they weren't a corporation. But also, like, I guess the logic of Toyota is, if there are people who need to buy a Republican congressman, it's a foreign car company known for having a lib demo who makes electric cars. So they could be the object of a ton of like regulation from like nationalist economic people. Like
the other thing is, like, maybe it's just me, but as a liberal, like, it's weird to me that any of us have a standard for corporations. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, my assumption is that they're all fucking nefarious, shady, and, you know, like, they're corporations. Like, I don't like.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just not.
They don't have morals.
Any of this type of shit that ever comes out. It's like, what do you think? What do you think Toyota was doing? It's just weird to me.
Corporations don't have morals. And by the way, just look up what Toyota was doing during World War II if you wonder why they were, if they would support right wing political fanatics. Anyway, I don't know. I don't understand why, like, we got to project, like, everything's branding now. Everything's that we all think our purchasing power is politics, and we think it's like, that's the way you do things. We've got to, like, this corporation's good and that one's bad. It's like, no, you got to, like Nick was talking about, like, some people are bad.
Gypsy Mama. I like this. Good point. Well, Ford went and made that communist electric F-150. So that's true. How the tables have turned. You got Ford out here making these commie electric trucks while Toyota's supporting the true patriots. Who'd have thought?
What I'm saying is, like, you can't be like, this corporation's good, this one's bad. That's why you have to have rules. You get, like Nick said, you have to have a rule for people to follow. You got to enact laws. Otherwise, because it's always a race to the bottom with these motherfuckers. Like, it's like everybody's trying to grab the last dollar they can.
I would just assume that any massive corporation on the level of Toyota donates all kinds of money to all kinds of candidates. Would have been before I even heard anything about this story, if you just asked me, I would have said, oh yeah, I'm sure they'd make all kinds of donations across the board to everybody, because why wouldn't they? You know, they're playing the game at that level or whatever. I'm still blown away at the amount of money we're actually talking about. I completely misinterpreted that. And
yeah, it's very easy to do.
Wow.
But so, but like, you'd think, like, if companies were forward thinking at all, Toyota should be supporting the people who support the Green New Deal, because higher fuel standards would sell a bunch of fucking Priuses. But they're living quarterly report to quarterly report. They're just deathly worried about Republicans passing a law that says for a certain percentage of vehicles have to be run on gas, because you're doing shit like that at the state level, trying to fuck over renewable energy. So it's like, yeah.
Also, just the fact that, like, the thing that's really fucked up is that, you know, like you said earlier, it's like, oh, they've bought all these congressmen for this amount of money. And it's like, the fact that that can even happen. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's that's almost just taken for granted in this conversation. You know, it's like, you donate money, you get there, you curry their favor. And it's like, yeah. And that's fucked up. Like, that. Why the hell are we still doing that? Aaron McCullough, friend of the show, says, I'll never buy one of those fascist Toyotas. I'll stick with a true patriot brand like Nissan. That's right. Yes. All-American Nissan.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all just – I've also seen it pointed out before that, like, in the world we live in today, like, this consumerist society we're in, it's literally almost impossible to like ethically consume anything. Do you know what I mean? At this point, which I believe to be true. And I know that's like cynical and defeatist or whatever, but I also think it's just the reality, you know? So,
no. I mean, every piece of clothing I'm wearing, I bet was made by a child. You know, it's right. like I don't know. Like, it's like, so you bought a Prius, okay, with a lithium in the battery, probably came from a mine in Bolivia that was obtained via a coup. I don't know. It's right. like, I don't know what to say.
Or if you're tweeting condemning Toyota from your iPhone or whatever.
Yeah. Right?
The classic example. Like, you know.
Yeah. It's,
yeah. Well, you know, hey, there's no hope. Nothing hits. That's our closing out here.
There is hope.
There is hope. I believe so.
Vote for people that can change shit.
All right. As a reminder, I'm going on tour again for the first time in over a year. Please come see me. Go to wellredcomedy.com. WellRedComedy.com. Get your tickets, see the dates, and come see me out there on that old dusty trail. I sure would appreciate it. I'm Trey, and that's Mark. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next week on Weekly Skews.
Skew.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.